Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Natural gas is getting cheaper. Pennies are getting more expensive, and robots are indeed eating our jobs. Yeah, it's a little bit of everything on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 30th of March. Good to have you with us. You know how we touch on oil prices from time to time as a way to stay connected to the energy economy? Man, that is so passé. Welcome to the world not of constantly rising crude, but of natural gas prices at 10-year lows this week. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why and why it matters.
The natural gas industry in the U.S. has been on a bit of a tear, at least when it comes to supply. Michael Giberson is a professor at Texas Tech University.
Well, we've just had a surprising boom of production over the last couple of years.
Expectations were rewritten in the last decade, along with the development of a controversial technique known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, that's opened up huge reserves of natural gas.
You hear numbers like, you know, a 50-year supply, a 100-year supply, and even bigger. I think that there's enough of a supply that we don't have to worry about it.
At least for a long, long time. All that supply has pushed prices down to 10-year lows. Charles Ebinger is director of the Energy Security Initiative at Brookings.
Natural gas represents, I think, a game changer for the United States energy situation and for our economy.
Ebinger says there's growing demand in the export market and here at home. Power companies are looking for alternatives to coal. The transportation sector wants alternatives to oil. And manufacturing?
We're already seeing some petrochemical and chemical companies that moved out of the country and located offshore now saying that despite higher U.S. labor costs, that cheap natural gas will offset that and make us one of the lowest cost places in the world for major manufacturing production.
All those changes could mean more jobs, Ebinger says, and natural gas prices that are likely higher than they are today. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
I have on the shelf in my office a jar full of pennies. Maybe, what, 20, 25 bucks just sitting there collecting dust? You multiply that by a zillion similar jars across the country and the fact that the cost to make a penny is now more than a penny is worth, and you have to wonder why the U.S. Mint keeps on cranking them out. But crank we do. North of the border, though, no longer Canada has decided enough is enough that pennies just aren't worth it anymore. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Pat Martin has been trying to get rid of the Canadian penny for 6 years now. He's a member of parliament from Manitoba.
The government of Canada has finally seen fit to give the penny its proper due, a proper funeral.
Now, it's going to be a slow death. The government won't make any new pennies, but it's still going to recognize them. Martin says making new pennies has cost the Canadian government somewhere between $10 and $20 million a year. And the coin has become a nuisance.
People don't even pick them up off the street anymore in this country. They'll walk right past them. It outlived its usefulness a long, long time ago, and I'm surprised it's taken us this long.
Thanks to inflation, the penny's purchasing power is 1/20 what it used to be. Martin says that in Canada, cash transactions will change.
Store owners and customers can round up and round down in a cash purchase to the nearest nickel.
And experts say all that will even out. So now to the big question. As I break open a roll of American pennies, is there any chance we'll follow in Canada's footsteps? Jeff Gore leads a group called Citizens for Retiring the Penny.
Many countries around the world have phased out their equivalent of the 1 cent piece, and the sky has not fallen.
Like New Zealand, the Netherlands, and the list goes on. Gore, who's also an MIT physics professor, says he's done the math, and at a time when the U.S. government is looking for ways to save money, getting rid of the penny, which costs almost 2 cents to make, would be a no-brainer. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
From pennies now to, well, a whole lot more, an item about the $640 million lottery jackpot that has otherwise rational people piling into what is essentially a no-win deal. A spokesman for the Mega Millions lottery said today that based on how many people are buying tickets and how quickly they're buying them, they estimate 95% of all possible number combinations will have been bought by jackpot time. So if you do draw the winning numbers, chances are you're going to have to share it with me. But Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports it's not just ticket buyers who are counting their winnings. States are hoping for a pot of gold as well.
It's easy to get carried away thinking about how you'll spend that $640 million.
Mega Millions. Dream big. Mega big.
Taxes may not be in your fantasy, but the federal government will get about 35% right off the top. And financial planner Susan Bradley says it doesn't stop there.
Then there's state tax, city tax, county tax. If you live in Manhattan, you're probably paying around 45%.
Whichever state a person lives in, that state gets a huge windfall.
Stephen Cordy is with Washington, D.C.'s Office of Tax and Revenue. He says taxes from a local lottery winner could make a big difference in a cash-strapped state. In the district's case, the take would be nearly 9%.
We had a few years ago, we had a Powerball winner, you know, and that was a piece of very good fortune for the district because we got a lump sum, multiple million-dollar tax payment out of it.
Good fortune because Cordy says the district got its tax money up front. But even if the winner takes an annual payout, Cordy says D.C. would be looking at $2 million a year over several years. That's enough to make a sizable dent in the police salaries. And a quick note to the winner if you're out there, Susan Bradley says don't complain about your taxes.
Once you're a lottery winner, people don't really, you know, have much sympathy for anything that goes wrong in your life.
But don't worry. The odds are you won't have to concern yourself with that. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Much has been happening, I'm sure, in offices all over the country the past couple of days. We, too, have been playing the What If You Win the Lottery game here at Marketplace.
Yeah, I'm probably going to buy one, you know, because $176 million,
them are good odds.
I mean, I'm already a winner in life, but it would be great to have almost $1 billion to go with that.
I mean, look, if I want to buy the nicest house in L.A., that's going to take most of my jackpot right there. Why even play?
I got to tell you, I'm kind of counting on it. Jeff Peters, Millie Jefferson, and Ben Adair, some of the Marketplace lottery hopefuls today. As far as the lottery that is Wall Street, no big winners. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've come to that point on a Friday where we pause and consider what the heck happened this past week. It was, I think we can all agree, quite a week. So here for our wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Catherine Rample from the New York Times, John Carney from CNBC. They're in our tiny little studio booth in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Catherine, you go first since you're the new one. Did you buy your lottery ticket yet?
I have not.
Oh, come on. Are you gonna?
No.
Really?
The lottery is a stupidity tax.
Yes, but come on.
But I'll spend that kind of money on beer.
That's what I was going to say.
And I have no chance of winning anything from that, you know, or probably no chance of winning.
Yeah, but how much more happiness do you get from a beer versus a lottery ticket that buys you nothing and then you feel stupid afterwards?
If you're going to be sensible about it, fine. We'll just move right on. Listen, let me ask you about real stuff here. The report that came out this morning that consumer spending is up for the, you know, biggest jump in 7 months. Are we possibly at a place where consumers are feeling good again, lottery aside?
I would say don't hold your breath for a number of reasons. The weather was unseasonably warm, so that could also kind of have influenced things in that people were more likely to go shopping than stay holed up at home.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, incomes were not up very much. They definitely disappointed. And it's very hard to sustain consumer spending growth
right.
if people aren't getting the money to pay for things.
So, John, is this another case of us relying on the consumers to boost the economy and it not being sustainable?
I actually think this might be sustainable. Wages are up and people spend based on how much money they expect to have in the future. If they think they're going to be prosperous, they're willing to part with more of their cash now because they're not sort of hoarding it to save it against, you know, getting unemployed mm-hmm. in the future, not seeing that raise. So I think there's a new confidence out there, and I think that we might see continued consumption growth.
And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, John Carney plays the lottery. I'm just saying. He's a believer. Catherine, I'm sure you saw the front page of your newspaper this morning, yes?
I did.
All right. The picture above the fold there, the riots in Barcelona and unrest in Spain. It seems to me it's been a while since we've heard about Europe, and now we're hearing about Europe that's not Greece. Are you worried?
Well, other parts of Europe besides Greece, I should say, have been having lots of problems that have just sort of flown under the radar in the United States. I mean, Spain has been having problems for years. About a quarter of its workers can't find jobs. So they've been, I mean, the rioting thing, that's nothing new. They're still feeling a lot of pain.
However, it is unusual, right, to see it not to see it happen, but to see it get big play here in the States in a country that's not Greece, right, Catherine?
Yeah, that is interesting. I guess it's because, I mean, I don't know what the top editors were thinking precisely when they decided to put that on the front page, but I can imagine that the American public, I mean, I'm not sure the American public paid that much attention to Greece when it looked like things were spinning out of control, and now people have really basically put that on the back burner.
Right.
And there's still kind of a latent concern about what could be happening across the pond that people should probably be paying attention to.
Well, John, there was talk this morning. I mean, they're boosting the European bailout fund. I mean, that whole thing continues, if we could just touch on that one last time.
Sure, yeah. I think actually that eventually they're going to have to use that bailout fund. Their hope is that they will boost it big enough that it's what I call the bazooka theory. Hank Paulson said it a long time ago.
Bet.
If you carry a pistol, you might have to use it. If you carry a bazooka, you hope you won't. That's always proven untrue. They will have to use it. They particularly might have to use it in Spain because one of the things the riot shows is people aren't very happy with these cuts that the government is doing over there. They're raising taxes. They're cutting spending. The economy is going to shrink. Unemployment's going to go up. People are going to say, why do we have to keep paying the bondholders while I'm out of a job? This is a political tinderbox. It's going to blow, and that bazooka is going to have to become a fire hose to put out the fire.
And besides that, I mean, you could argue that the government is sort of shooting itself in the foot. I mean, on the one hand, they do have to pull back the size of their state. They do have to raise more money, but both of those measures are terrible for growth, and already the economy is shrinking. And if the country isn't growing, that means tax revenues go down, and it makes it even harder to pay back your bondholders.
So you'll not be buying a Spanish lottery ticket then, Catherine?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe their combination of numbers
has better chances
than those in the United States. Yeah. I confess I have not looked into it.
Catherine Rampell of the New York Times, John Carney from CNBC. Have yourselves a good weekend, you guys. Thanks.
Thanks.
You too.
Coming up.
Without the robots, there's no way we could have grown our business this fast.
So maybe it's good that robots are eating our jobs? Maybe. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 66 points today. That's a 0.5%. Closed at 13,212. The Dow's best first quarter, by the way, since 1998. It means you can only go down from here, one guesses. The Nasdaq fell 3 points, 0.1%. Finished at 3,091. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.3%. Ended things at 1,408. For the week, the Dow up 1%. The Nasdaq gained 0.8%. The S&P 500 also put on 0.8%. After its latest credit card security breach, MasterCard charged down 1.8% today. Visa slid 0.8%. Global Payments, the transaction processor in question, lost 9%. Micron Technologies deleted nearly 4% today after adjusting earnings to account for a legal settlement with Oracle 2 years ago. Oracle took off 0.5%. Rival chipmaker SanDisk erased 1.25% today. JPMorgan Chase up 0.2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for February. The Prime Minister of Canada and the President of Mexico join President Obama in Washington for a summit. And on April 2nd, 1792, Congress passed the Coinage Act. That created the Mint and authorized construction of a mint building in Philadelphia, the nation's capital at the time, soon after it began issuing money. Money remains relevant to this day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
The news was filled with big, big issues this week. Healthcare and the Supreme Court, Foxconn and Apple. Also, robots. and our jobs. You'll hear installment number 5 of our series, Robots Ate My Job, in just a couple of minutes. But Patrick Hegday from New York City was surprised the other day when he heard us offer grocery store self-checkouts as examples of robots eating human jobs.
It's always seemed to me more like stores were foisting the work their cashiers used to do onto their decidedly human customers. Alas, I guess the next time I find myself tapping away at the touchscreen of a self-checkout and scanning and bagging all my items, I'll remember that it's really robots who are doing all the work.
Todd Buchholz's commentary lambasting the boomerang generation drew fire from scores of our younger listeners. An aversion, he said, to risk has crept into the psyches of our young people. Like many listeners his age, 28-year-old A.J. Million from Columbia Mo took offense at being called Generation Why Bother.
Correlation does not imply causation. There's no reason to believe that today's young adults are any different than previous ones. Sure, more young people are choosing to live with their parents, but the economy has been the major factor in driving this, not listlessness.
And on a personal note, Scott Aramaki from Davis, California, thinks I may or may not have issues, shall we say, with a certain Dr. Seuss character, and he suggests a possible vent for my frustrations.
I couldn't help notice that Mr. Risdahl seems to harbor some inexplicably hostile sentiments toward the Lorax. Maybe Mr. Risdahl can use Dean Terry's Enemy Graph app to enemy the little orange tree hugger and get the animosity out of his system.
No, man, the Lorax is fine. It's the movie that I don't really... Whatever. Never mind. Feedback is our middle name. Give it to us. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. When last we heard from our roving correspondent David Brancaccio, he was on the loose somewhere in Nevada, bound for San Francisco, and the end of a coast-to-coast drive distinguishable for this, the absence of human interaction. Is it possible in the changing economy in which we live to literally drive across the country and not do business with a single actual person? And if so, what does that mean for humans and the jobs that we do? Here's David one last time for our series, Robots Ate My Job.
Matun Jacobs is practicing surgery.
It's a pretty complicated task, so sometimes I forget what I need to do next.
I said practicing. Lucky for all concerned, the patient's a dummy, plastic. Matun is a PhD student at Purdue's Industrial Engineering Program. He's in the computer lab testing out a robot he helped create.
Scalpel.
It's called Gesto Nurse. Think of it as a robotic scrub nurse or scrub tech.
Scissors.
And its job is to hand over surgical instruments during an operation. Gesto Nurse is designed to solve a potentially fatal challenge in the real operating room.
One of the problems is miscommunications between the surgical tech and the surgeon. I ask for an instrument and I receive a different instrument.
That's Dr. Juan Wax, the professor who helped design this, a machine that's also good at preventing what he calls retained instruments, retained as in surgical tools being sewed up inside patients by mistake.
This is one example where you take human-robot collaboration, human-robot interaction, human-robot work to the same place where the stakes are the highest. And if we can make it there, that will be great.
Note all the togetherness. The idea is partnership with robots. Gesto Nurse could be in hospitals within 5 years. It makes sense that we get our economy ready for this, and this idea of machine-human collaboration could be a cornerstone for how to think about the workforce of the future. Daniel Collins used to have to run miles around the warehouse for Acumen Brands, a relatively small internet retailer in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
And now these guys do the walking for us, so that's really good.
Among his co-workers in the warehouse are 8 humans and a platoon of robots that scoot along like hovercraft the size of snow tires.
Our warehouse guys would climb up like ring-tailed lemurs on the side of these shelves and pull these huge boxes with 30 or 40 items in it, rifle through them, find the one that they think was really good.
That's John James, CEO of Acumen, which owns brands like TheHecticGourmet.com and Trails Edge.
You know, compare that today. You know, we have robots that drive the shelf over to the worker, and a laser shines down from the heavens above and points the exact item to pull out. I scan it with a barcode and confirms they got the right item. Even an idiot like me could do it. They'll even let me pick an order.
These robots are all the rage at the big retailers. In fact, just last week, Amazon bought the company that makes these robots, Kiva Systems, for $750 million. But for a small company like Acumen, the robots triggered something unexpected. More jobs for people, not fewer. And not just more, but better.
Without the robots, there's no way we could have grown our business this fast. You know, we have 6 or 8 guys in the warehouse now. And to create higher-paying, white-collar jobs of marketers, programmers, developers, and much needed in the state of Arkansas.
So human-machine collaboration is one way to surf the wave of automation. But what else? How about training teachers in technology to make sure future workers are super skilled? Or how about teaching entrepreneurship beyond elite business schools to encourage more middle-class people to start cool enterprises that hire people? Plus, there's this idea from MIT economist David Autor. Why not pay to retrain workers when it's innovation that eats their jobs?
You can't blame Bill Gates for taking your job. You can't blame Steve Jobs. That's technology, not trade. We could do more and would benefit from doing more to prevent that kind of dislocation from being career-ending.
Meanwhile, researchers are well aware that they can't build a future where technology does all the work and humans are left sipping big gulps in front of the flat screen.
What I'm really excited about is getting people and robots to work together.
David Bourne is a principal scientist at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute. Normally, you think of people programming machines to install parts in a factory. Instead, Bourne's team made a robot that uses a beam to guide humans to place parts correctly.
So basically, it's like having your computer console everywhere in the world.
Teamwork of the if you can't beat 'em, join 'em kind that could wildly speed up custom manufacturing and rejuvenate this beleaguered sector. Imagine going to buy a new car, Bourne says, and picking out not just the color, but the custom shape for delivery in a couple of days.
You could pick up your new Batmobile that you've designed yourself. How amazing would that be? And you'd be really excited to buy it and pay for it. It's mind-boggling.
As long as all this human-machine partnership produces the kind of salaries for living, breathing human beings that would allow us to afford these innovations.
We have tracked down Mr. Brancaccio mere miles from his destination. And David, first of all, I have to say, I'm the first human you've talked to in a week, right?
Yeah, it's what a treat it is to talk to you as the first human.
So let me ask you, though. I mean, the theme of this thing was, can you do it? And yes, you clearly did. But was it worth it, man? Was it hard and lonely and isolating?
It was pretty alienating. But you know what, Kai? You and me, guys like me, men and women, have been in training for this. We spend a lot of our time already buried in our iPad screens and smartphones. And so I was ready for the experience of loneliness because we seem to do it almost every day. Hmm. But I'll tell you, I wasn't quite successful. I couldn't avoid human contact on a number of occasions. There was a supermarket self-service checkout with a super-duper customer service person who insisted on helping me with an ear of corn that I couldn't scan. And there was a night manager at another hotel who's a big fan of your show, Kai, and he wanted to shake my hand. So I wasn't entirely alone in the end. But what I could do, what I was able to do, is I got coast to coast without ever transacting business with another human being, only machines.
Yeah. David Brancaccio. And our series, Robots Ate My Job. He's almost done. David, good work.
Thank you very much.
Our series was produced by Ann Hepperman with Stan Alcorn and Eliza Reynolds-Henn. And there is oh so much more on our website. Of course, pictures from the robotic nurse, videos as well, and the whole series, all the stories. It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Let's take a second as we part ways on a Friday to catch up on the news this week that didn't quite make the headlines. Comes to us courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
It's a bacon coffin.
Oh, really? Where does one get that?
For $3,000, a company in Seattle will give you a casket painted to look like slices of bacon. It includes a bacon air freshener on the inside so you can live in eternity with the smell of bacon.
Because this may be the first time that you can be buried in a replication of the thing that may have killed you.
Exactly.
Sally Herships, reporter for Marketplace. What's your story?
So the Beatles have just won a copyright infringement case against
the Beetle wheelchair.
What is the Beetle wheelchair?
It's just a wheelchair called the Beetle. It's made by a company in Holland, but the Beatles thought it was a little too close to their trademark.
What does a wheelchair have to do with rock and roll?
Well, as a judge pointed out, the audience that listens to the Beatles is now getting old enough so that it may need a wheelchair, thus potential confusion.
So I guess my Led Zeppelin hearing aids don't stand a chance.
Oh my God.
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Siri is getting sued.
Who is Siri?
She's the little voice in the new iPhone that supposedly answers all your questions and gives you recommendations.
So she's being... Why is she being sued?
Well, it's because of the supposedly. The Apple commercials show her answering every minute detail, but in reality, she doesn't always give the best answers or even understand what the heck you're asking.
Are they calling her to the witness stand?
Let's ask her. Siri, are you concerned about this lawsuit?
No comment.
The radio show Rico and Brendan do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to their podcast on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's it. That's the radio show called Marketplace from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, robots and one job in particular.
Hi, I'm Hal.
And I'm Rosie.
We are here to help Tess.
Yes. And to see if she could be replaced by a robot.
Rosie.
Oops.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.